We talk a lot on this show about eating disorders and disordered eating, but we don't often go into what normal eating should look like. And to help us understand the difference a little bit better, we called in the longtime director of the National Eating Disorder Collaboration, Dr. Beth Shelton. The NEDC develops the national standards for preventing and treating eating disorders. And Beth is a psychologist and a highly respected professional in the field. So we thought that she was possibly the top person in the country to ask, what's the current definition of an eating disorder?
So an eating disorder is a mental illness with very serious physical and mental health consequences for the person who has it. Another way of looking at it is that an eating disorder is an entrenched pattern of disordered eating and sort of thinking and feeling about body image and shape and weight and about yourself that causes a lot of mental suffering and a lot of dysfunction in life, especially around food and eating, but also in terms of social life, in terms of cognition, in terms of getting on with life and having the life that you want to have.
As one of the country's top experts on this, can you take us through what some of the more well-known diagnoses of eating disorder might be, and then maybe let's dig into some of the ones that we don't know so well.
There's a growing view in the world, actually, that eating disorders, forms of eating disorder, have more in common with each other than they have separations, because it's often true that people might have one form of an eating disorder, such as bulimia nervosa or anorexia nervosa, but that actually changes over time. So diagnoses are important in that they help the field and for people who have lived experience of an eating disorder be able to identify what kind of pattern of eating it is and what kind of pattern of difficulty the person has so that we can target treatments. But there's a lot that's in common underneath and underlying those eating disorders. For example, increasingly we're understanding that a kind of genetic basis of anxiety and anxiety management underlies and is true for many people who have eating disorders. There's become a kind of psychology and a preoccupation with weight and shape as a measure of self-worth for that person. Another aspect that's likely to be true right across the eating disorders is that the person restricts their intake. That might take a number of kind of different forms across the eating disorders, but that there's a kind of desire to over-control the intake of food. And these are some of the things that are true across diagnoses.
Yeah, wow, that makes a lot of sense, Beth. So there's 8 or maybe even more different diagnoses for eating disorders at the moment. But could you tell us about some of the big ones? And by big ones, I mean some of the more predominant ones that we see a lot.
So I'll take you through 4 different kinds of eating disorder diagnoses that differ from each other. The eating disorder that people tend to have in their minds when they immediately think of an eating disorder is anorexia nervosa, because it's the most commonly known eating disorder, and it's because it's the most obvious in terms of a person's weight and shape and appearance. So in anorexia nervosa, the person has ideas and beliefs and feelings around weight and shape and the control of those things, which really overtake them, and they are kind of driven in a sense to reduce the food intake that they have. And that creates both kind of reinforces for them that they sometimes are able to numb feelings in relation to that that starvation kind of response, but it also tends to make people lose certain amount of cognitive function, being it leads to underweight and to sort of starvation response, which then kind of makes a person stuck in their cognitions. And sometimes it's very difficult to see the big picture because the brain kind of shuts down in a certain kind of way. And it also tends to lead to social isolation. So the person has difficulty with being flexible enough to eat with other people and to be with other people. So you get this vicious cycle, in a sense, of restricting food and the effects of restricting food on the brain and the body and on the social life, tending to reinforce that, if that makes sense. So the person is stuck in this pattern that's hard to get out of because of the distress that comes from changing that rigid pattern of eating.
So that's anorexia nervosa. Okay, so, and most people have heard of anorexia nervosa. It sounds awful, and, of course, the potential outcomes are horrible. But as you mentioned earlier, it's not the most common eating disorder. What are some others that you can tell us about?
So let's think about bulimia nervosa, which is probably the eating disorder that people think of second after they've thought of anorexia nervosa or they know about. So what happens in bulimia nervosa is, again, the person has ideas, rigid ideas and overvalued ideas about how important weight and shape might be for them as a person, and really strong desire to control weight and shape. So they do the same thing. So they tend to diet or restrict their intake. And that dietary restriction naturally creates an enormous pressure on the person to eat, because we are survival. We're survival organisms, aren't we? And we want to survive. So when the body feels itself to be underfed, to be starving, it sends lots of signals up into the brain and into the body itself to sort of eat, get the person to eat. So the person then breaks their restriction, and because they have got a lot of physiological pressure built up and psychological pressure built up around rules and all of that kind of thing, when they eat, it's often possible for them to eat more than they wanted to. Or even if they don't, they experience then a sense that they have broken the rules, and enormous distress sometimes around that, and fears that have to do with the need to rigidly control weight and shape and eating. So then the person might do an activity, what we'd call a compensatory activity, in order to kind of compensate for the fact that they've eaten. You get a kind of pattern of them doing compensatory behaviours, which is what we call them, and then feeling pretty bad about having done those compensatory behaviour, about the eating, and then doing the compensatory behaviour and then going around the cycle again. So I've done my exercise now, I sort of feel better, I'm back in control, I'll restrict my intake again, but the cycle keeps repeating itself because it has sort of physiological and emotional and motivational kind of triggers that just keep happening. So again, you're stuck in a cycle of behaviours and thoughts and feelings that are pretty painful and hard to be stuck in, but take some effort and some support to get out of.
They both have got the word nervosa attached to them. So can you explain to us what that means?
Look, they're old diagnostic terms, and I guess they refer to the nervous system, but I can't say much more than that.
Okay, well, thanks for clearing that up. Sorry to break your flow. I think we're up to 2 out of 4.
So that was number 2. Number 3 is a more recent eating disorder diagnosis. I'm talking now about formal diagnoses. Binge eating disorder is a more recent formal diagnosis. And what happens in binge eating disorder is the person doesn't necessarily restrict their intake, although they are likely to have and do have most of the time some distorted and upsetting ideas around self-worth, weight and shape, and needing to control those in order to feel like a good person. So typically the typical pattern would be the person would restrict a fair bit of food during the day and not eat very much, and then eat a lot of food at night would be the typical pattern, but it doesn't have to work that way. What a binge is not what people kind of think it is. It's not like when I go to the staff room and I say, oh, I had a real binge last night, I had a packet of chocolate royals, you know. That's comfort eating because I feel sad or lonely or something like that, and just for the time of it, it's fine. It makes me feel a little bit better in the short term. That's just emotional eating, and a certain amount of emotional eating or spontaneous eating and eating sweet things, eating with friends, is just part of normal eating. But a binge is a different thing from that. So in a binge, a person eats more than would be considered a kind of normal amount of food, a fair bit more than that, in a certain discrete period of time, and experiences feeling really out of control in their eating. So it's a very specific kind of eating, and that recurs often in the person's life more than, say, 3 times a week. So the person's caught in this sort of spiral, probably of restriction, but not necessarily, and then the binge becomes something that it's very hard to avoid and it's very hard to change from. And that's partly because it provides a kind of emotional kind of cycle to it, and also it becomes like a physiological habit. So binge eating is quite painful for most people who have it, and they often feel pretty awful afterwards, but the cycle sort of drags them in, they come around and do it again. So it's associated with really quite serious dysfunction and suffering for the person, and it's much more serious than I think that anyone understood when we first started looking at this pattern of behaviour.
Sorry to interrupt you again there, Beth, but I understand binge eating disorder is hugely underdiagnosed. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. And in fact, binge eating disorder is likely to be, it is the more people have binge eating disorder than have anorexia or bulimia. And interestingly, the binge eating disorder is close to equal between males and females experience binge eating disorder and across the age groups. And it's often people who are older. So it really cuts across some of those stereotypes that we have. So when people think of anorexia nervosa, they tend to think of a teenage girl. Probably a white teenage girl. You know, there's a kind of cultural stereotype there, but that's not true. What eating disorders really are, eating disorders are mental illnesses that appear across the different cultural groups, across different kinds of life states, across different occupations, everything that you can think of that makes people different. Eating disorders still exist, and certainly across gender, and increasingly across gender.
Yeah, we're starting to get an idea that it's not so much just the young, wealthy, white woman, which is the stereotype which we're presented in the media the most often, but it does really cut through almost every demographic, the eating disorder diagnoses, that is. And the stereotype is really quite unhelpful.
No, that's right, exactly. So eating disorders affect people of all genders, ages, races, ethnicities, body shapes and weights, sexual orientation and socioeconomic status. And you can't tell from the outside if somebody has an eating disorder. It just isn't only that thing that we kind of carry as a shortcut, as a cognitive shortcut in our brain, as you say, of that skinny kind of teenager.
I promise I'm going to let you finish explaining the diagnosis and answering the question that I initially asked. And I think you had one more.
So the last one I'll talk about is a little bit different from the eating disorders I've talked about before. And that it's called ARFID, so avoidant restrictive intake disorder. And ARFID is a little bit different in that the person doesn't necessarily or probably doesn't even have any sort of real concerns or cognitions around weight or shape or the need to control food in that sense. But the person is likely to be very, they may have been, for example, what used to be called a picky eater as a child. So the person may actually have an underlying lack of appetite biologically. They may have had a traumatic kind of episode with food and swallowing, like a vomiting episode. That's kind of created almost like a phobic relationship with food. Or they may have highly kind of rigid things around which food they can eat or not. So you might have heard of people, for example, who will only eat white food or people who will only eat sort of carrots and broccoli, or people who will only eat junk food. So highly specific sort of preferences. And when that becomes a problem is when the person isn't able to meet their nutritional needs because they have such rigid sort of setups around their food. So ARFID often might start earlier, have an earlier onset than other eating disorders. As I say, it's not associated with the same kind of distress around weight and shape, but it can be very problematic in terms of the person being able to have a good life because they can't eat enough food to satisfy what they need to be healthy.
So those are the four main diagnoses, and I think now we've identified something like eight, but like a lot of other mental illnesses, they're also kind of, there's a lot of overlap and there's a lot of people who might swing from one to the other. Can you sort of take us through the how they interrelate with each other?
So the diagnostic categories are useful in that they help us sort of name what's going on for people, which can be really, really useful, and to help us target treatments to a degree. But it's also important to realise that all of these patterns are patterns of eating that just cause a lot of suffering to the person within them, and that they're rigid and hard to get out of, and that they are associated with a lot of mental preoccupation and obsession and behavioural sort of rigidity and also social isolation a lot of the time. A lot of the things go together.
We've said it often on the podcast that eating disorders are the mental illness with the highest fatality rate. And I guess it's reasonably obvious why that might be, but can you take us through some of the dangers? What is it about eating disorders that makes them such a dangerous condition for people to have?
So sadly, you're absolutely right that mental illnesses have certainly one of the highest mortality rates of any mental illness, if not the highest. And they also have a high level of chronicity, as in becoming very, very long-term illnesses that compromise a person's life dreadfully. So they're life-threatening on a number of levels in that way. But they also can be something that someone can have and then get completely well, you know. So that's why our intervention, I guess, into them is just so important, because what's at stake for the individual person is a lot. It can be between having a perfectly normal life and having complete recovery and really a very compromised life, or, as you say, even death. So, yeah.
Yeah, and it seems to me this is another area where that stereotype really does us another disservice, where people don't see the seriousness of eating disorders. And if they do, they only see the seriousness of anorexia nervosa. So I guess the question I've got for you here is it correct when I say people don't tend to understand the seriousness of eating disorders?
I think that's right. And I think, yeah, so a lot of people don't realise how serious eating disorders can be, and maybe have a bit of an idea that an eating disorder is a choice that a person is making. An eating disorder is never a choice once you're into it. It may be that you might have started off with dieting and that has triggered an eating disorder, and the desire to diet was a choice, but the eating disorder is never a choice. And no one I've ever worked with or spoken to about an eating disorder would ever choose one, or would choose one for anybody else or suggest it, because it's just far too much suffering and dysfunction associated with it. So they're serious biologically influenced illnesses. They're not choices. If you're eating normally, you're pretty much choosing food because for hunger and preference and whatever your values are around food, and you're happy to eat with other people pretty flexibly. You don't typically feel a great deal of guilt or shame about eating. You mightn't be absolutely delighted with your body, but you've got a reasonable degree. This is my body and, you know, it does good things for me and it's going to carry me through life and I'm okay with it. And generally, you know, your weight's at a reasonable kind of healthy level for you if you're eating well.
What are some warning signs for disordered eating or even an eating disorder?
Here are some of the things you might see. You might see them dieting or fasting. You might see them withdrawing from other people. You might see them doing exercise, which carries a sort of quite a compulsive kind of character to it, where they can't, they'll put other things, they'll put the exercise before other things in their life. They might use steroids or things like that. They might change in their food preferences. So things that people used to like and were always happy with, all of a sudden they don't eat anymore, and they're quite strong about that. They might feel the need to kind of avoid situations or they feel a lot of guilt and shame around eating. That might be evident to you if they're someone that you know well. You might notice that they sort of over-focus on food, weight and shape. You can see it comes into conversation a lot. There's a lot of comparisons and ideas and everything about food, weight and shape, recipes, all these sorts of things. You might just notice that they're anxious when it comes to meal times or whatever. They might be avoiding, like used to go to a cafe, have a nice, you know, muffin and a coffee. It doesn't happen anymore, you know, there's avoidance.
Yeah.
Notice that they're checking their body all the time, you know, kind of checking to see, pinching, looking, you know, what's my body doing in terms of its appearance. You might find just that they're less happy, that they're anxious and they seem down and distant from you. And you might see that perhaps their weight goes up and down or fluctuates or something like that. So they're the classic symptoms, I guess, that you might notice.
From your work as a psychologist or as a clinician, I suppose, do you have any examples you could share with us?
Yeah, I was talking to a mum who had a little boy. When I say little, he was primary school, who ended up being diagnosed with anorexia nervosa. And I think he was a kid who was maybe a little bit over his most comfortable weight. And that can be a real trigger for kids. And he was like, right, I'm going to restrict my food and I'm going to do really well. So he started, you know, dieting, I guess, and also started running around the oval. And he lost a bit of weight and everybody was saying to him, oh, that's so good, you're doing so well. And his mother just started feeling that he wasn't that happy though. And she went running with him one day around the oval, and she said the moment that they started running around the oval, she knew something was wrong. Because he wasn't running as a normal person. He was running in a kind of state that was really anxious and really compulsive. And she knows her son well, you know, of course. So she could feel that there was a way he was engaging in that that just wasn't right. And then she started finding out he wasn't eating his lunch at school. And, you know, it kind of built from there. But I guess when you're close to someone, like you're their friend or their really close sports person or you're their parent, you kind of know how they are normally, so you can feel it out. And if you have a sense that something is going wrong, it's really worthwhile kind of, you know, sort of raising it with them and seeing if you can get them to talk to someone who can help them to sort of pull that out and see what needs to be done.
Wow, thank you for sharing. I guess that puts it in a very real kind of setting for us. I appreciate that. The next couple of things I wanted to ask you about, Beth, were orthorexia and disordered eating, which are not technically in the eating disorder family or diagnoses, if you like. How do they relate, and can you shed a bit of light on exactly what they are for us?
Absolutely. So disordered eating is really kind of on a spectrum, I guess, between what I just described, which is normal eating, which is sort of social and kind of appetite and a little bit of health and all of that, through to kind of eating disorder behaviour. So some of the things I just said are actually disordered eating. So extreme dieting, fasting, kind of just not being able to eat in a way that is a normal responsive pattern is disordered eating. All of those kinds of things are really serious disordered eating. They're absolute red flags, and they're moving into clinical eating disorder kind of territory, which I hope most people would recognise those if they see them.
Yeah.
Disordered eating and also body image concerns are well-documented risk factors for doing extreme eating behaviours and then triggering an eating disorder.
Well, look, we're running out of time a little bit here, Beth, but before we wrap up, I'd like to get your take on what a healthy relationship with food looks like. What do you think that's supposed to be?
You'd feel free. You get up in the morning and you, you know, you've got food you like and food you don't like, and you've got a vague idea of, you know, what you want to include in that day's eating, and you're going to eat when you're hungry, and you're going to eat things that you like eating, so that there's pleasure in it and there's a rhythm to it, so that you're probably eating breakfast and you're eating lunch and you're eating dinner, so that you're keeping your body and your mind well fueled on every level, and you don't feel ashamed or sort of guilty, or your eating isn't tied to trying to get to a sort of particular number or a kind of particular body shape. You just accept that I'm a human, so I've got needs to eat, and I'm going to balance healthy food with sort of yummy food and food that I have when I'm with grandma, because she made me a chocolate cake and I'm going to have some. And you're generally going to feel pretty vital, pretty, you know, got enough energy to do what I need to do, and you're comfortable and spontaneous about your eating. You're not going around in your head all the time thinking about what I should and shouldn't be eating. It's a bit like, I think of it, it's a bit like trying to train a kitten, you know, to jump through hoops. Like, a kitten isn't meant to. A kitten's meant to be what a kitten does as an organism. Our eating needs to be kind of, some people say intuitive, but it needs to be kind of just part of our life that we do, that we don't over-control, because when we try and over-control our eating, it can lead into all sorts of, you know, these patterns I've been describing, these diagnoses, these difficulties and this suffering that's actually really hard to shift. So don't over-control your eating. Just do your eating, you know, eat enough, eat regularly, eat adequately, eat good things that are good for you, and eat other stuff sometimes.
To find out more about what Beth does with the National Eating Disorders Collaboration, go to nedc.com.au. And as always, if you need support right now, or if you'd just like to know a little bit more about eating disorders, call the Butterfly National Helpline on 1-800-334-673. That's 1-800-ED-HOPE. You can also chat online or look at all of the resources on the website at butterfly.org.au. My name's Sam Eichen. I'm the host and producer of Butterfly Let's Talk. Our executive producer is Camilla Beckett. And if you like what we're doing here, please leave us a rating and pop a little review in the app that you use to listen to this podcast. Until next time, thank you so much for your company.